It's the Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. What kind of food business keeps an 87-year-old going full steam ahead? Well, meet Sylvia of Sylvia Weinstock Cakes.
You know, it's not the making so much, but it is meeting the client, getting to know them, poking into their lives, which I love, and then designing with them, trying to figure out where their level of taste goes. And probably the best part is a day or two later, a thank you. And then maybe in about 18, 20 years, the daughter gets engaged and you do the next generation.
Lots more thinking in the long term this hour. And smoked fig leaf cookies, anybody? Stick around. That's this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. That old saying, tell me what you eat and I'll tell you who you are. Well, that's true, but how about historian Paul Friedman's take? Show me your restaurants, and I'll show you what's shaping your community. Take New York City in the 1830s. A new country, lots of new money, the era of more is more, as in the palatial restaurant Delmonico's, where, as the maitre d' seats you, he tucks a silk pillow at your back. The pillow is embroidered with your initials. Then he hands you the menu. It's printed in gold leaf on satin. Well, this is how Paul Friedman, the Yale historian, opens his story of 10 restaurants that changed America. Paul, good to have you back.
I'm delighted to be with you again.
So, 10 restaurants. Which ones did you choose?
So, in the order of the chapters that I devoted to them, and it's roughly chronological, Delmonico's is the first, a restaurant in New York that really defined elegant cuisine, French cuisine, but also with American specialties from its foundation in the 1830s until Prohibition closed it in the 1920s. Then Antoine's in New Orleans, a durable example of the most vibrant regional cuisine of the United States, the cuisine of Louisiana, of course. Then Schraft's, which was a middle-class restaurant, a restaurant that served ice cream, sandwiches, salads, but which was particularly appealing to women, not only as a place that women who were shopping or who worked in offices or stores might like, this at the beginning of the 20th century, but also served food that it was thought that women liked, basically light entrees and very rich desserts. So then Howard Johnson's, which was, like Schraft's, a kind of safe and in this case more family-friendly place for families with children, roadside restaurant, coast to coast. At its height in the early 1960s, more meals were served by Howard Johnson's than by anything except the U.S. Army. And then Mama Leone's, an Italian restaurant. So it's an example of one of the most popular so-called ethnic or international or foreign foods. The Mandarin, which is the example of Chinese food, the most popular foreign food of the United States. Sylvia's, an African-American restaurant that exemplifies the importance of African-American innovation and cuisine on American cuisine as a whole. Le Pavillon, which was a French restaurant and that defined elegant cuisine, high-end cuisine from 1941 when it was founded until the mid-1960s. The Four Seasons, founded in 1959, sleek, modern, very elegant, but deliberately not French, a place that defined seasonality and also pioneered the so-called power lunch, the business lunch of a certain kind of status and deal-making. And the last one, Chez Panisse in Berkeley, Alice Waters' creation, a restaurant that really moved from French to a kind of new American cuisine that emphasized seasons, quality of ingredients, locality, and without Chez Panisse, the way we dine out now would be inconceivable.
Why no McDonald's?
Well, partly because fast food restaurants aren't really restaurants in the sense that they don't have a very wide menu choice. There are no waiters. There are no menus except posted sort of above the order mm-hmm. window. So it's not exactly a restaurant. It's closer to takeout. The other reason is that Howard Johnson stands in for all fast food. It's the first franchised restaurant. It's the first rigorously standardized restaurant. It's family friendly. And it was also located on highways. So you would look for this brand and know what to expect.
Yeah. Had orange roofs. You couldn't miss them.
Right. And that was deliberate because Howard Deering Johnson, the founder, didn't believe in billboards, which were common in the 20s and 30s, and thought they were tacky. But in order for people to recognize the restaurant going 60 miles an hour with sufficient distance to make up their minds and stop, it had to have the orange roof.
Uh-huh. Delmonico's. You refer to it as the first real restaurant in the United States. When did it begin?
It began around 1830. It had been a pastry shop founded in 1827 and very quickly turned into a restaurant. It was the first restaurant in the sense that it was elegant, it had refined service, it emphasized the quality of ingredients. It was not relentlessly French, but it was basically a French restaurant. It described itself as the Restaurant Français Delmonico. So there had been sort of taverns with food, chop houses, places to have lunch, hotel dining rooms, but they tended to be necessities, places to dine quickly, mm-hmm. eat a lot of food, and get out. This was something new and something different and immediately acclaimed as such. Everybody throughout the entire 19th century considered Delmonico's the leading restaurant of the United States.
Uh-huh. Well, the other restaurant that I'd love to talk to you about is also in New York. It's Sylvia's, and it's in Harlem. This was a restaurant that welcomed everyone. It was a restaurant serving what people thought of as soul food. But white New Yorkers didn't go there.
Well, white New Yorkers had gone to Harlem as an entertainment district in the 20s, particularly, and in the 30s. But by the time Sylvia's opened in 1962, Harlem was on its way to being isolated from white New York. And although people from Harlem traveled all over New York and weren't themselves isolated, white New Yorkers tended not to come to Harlem out of fear of crime or just out of a sense that there was nothing there.
And then Gail Green, restaurant reviewer for New York Magazine and now other publications, did a review of Sylvia's. Tell us about that.
Yes. Well, she did a review of Sylvia's for New York Magazine. And it's an amazing review because it really shows you this isolation that I was referring to. And this is in 1979 in one issue of New York Magazine. Actually, her editor expressed some doubts about the wisdom of advising the white readership, or at least primarily or assumed to be white readership of New York, to go up to Harlem. You know, aren't we recommending that they do something dangerous if we write a review of a restaurant in Harlem? And she says she sort of agreed, but she went anyway. She had trouble getting a taxi to take her to Harlem. She was her review reads as if she was on some kind of exciting but dangerous expedition to an unknown territory. And then she was amazed and delighted by the welcome that Sylvia Woods, the proprietor, gave to her. Sylvia hugged her. She thought the food was great, although she had some reservations about some things. She loved the ribs and the fried chicken, but wasn't all that impressed by the cornbread, for example, which she said was wishy-washy. But she was just amazed at what a good time she had. She was amazed at how good the food was. She was amazed at the welcome that she had. And it gives you a sense, you know, not that life is so great now in every respect, but it gives you a picture of a New York that's not that long ago, but sociologically and culturally very different.
Well, Paul, there's 8 other restaurants to dig into. We need a couple of hours, but thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me. It's been great.
Paul Friedman's author of 10 Restaurants That Changed America. He is the Chester D. Tripp Professor of History at Yale University. Now, don't miss out on one of the 10 recipes that changed America. None other than my first gourmet addiction, Howard Johnson's fried clams. And you can find it at splendidtable.org. First sight of a Buddha's hand said centerpiece, bright yellow, looking like a big lemon with long, elegant fingers. It smelled of spice and honey. Startling to look at, but can you eat it? And if so, how? Buddha's hand goes on the list of produce that we've not seen much of before, like fig leaves, burdock root, purslane. Chefs are having a ball with these. And with a little orientation, we home cooks can too. Now, Michelle McKenzie, program director and chef at 18 Reasons, a nonprofit community cooking school in San Francisco, has written a book, Dandelion and Quince. It's devoted to different ingredients, the little known ones. Our contributor, Noelle Carter, went to her for some inspiration for the unusual.
Michelle, it's a pleasure to chat with you today. Thank you so much.
Hi, Noelle. I'm so excited to be here.
So, Michelle, you have an incredible chapter on fig leaves, and I'm used to eating figs, but who knew you could actually use the leaves? Can you tell me a little bit about them?
So fig leaves are often used to wrap cheeses. Some people cook fish in them. If you rub a fig leaf between your fingers, you'll get this amazing aroma of coconut or peat, vanilla, green walnut. They have this amazing aroma, and they impart that to the fish and to the cheese. And I just, you know, a few years ago, I just started buying a lot of them and playing around with them because I was kind of addicted to this fragrance.
Uh-huh.
And I even tried, you know, I dried some and put them into spice blends. I tried smoking some. And I really loved how the smoke kind of changed the quality, but kind of kept some of that mint and sweetness and vanilla, but made it a little bit earthy. And when I'm smoking fig leaves, I just want to stand in my kitchen for hours until the smell dissipates. And I've been grinding those smoked fig leaves up and powdering them with sugar and making desserts out of them. And they're just phenomenal.
Who would have thought fig leaves and desserts?
I know. Panna cotta. I have a recipe for panna cotta in the book, for smoked fig leaf cookies, which is my favorite shortbread recipe. It's super easy to make, and those cookies stay good for a really long time.
I can imagine the fragrance of the cookies with the smoked fig leaves. You know, one of the other ingredients that I'm finding in the markets right now are tomatillos. And you have a whole section on tomatillos, using them raw, using them cooked. And you have this incredible recipe for green fish stew. How did you come up with it? And sort of what was the inspiration?
Well, green sauces, you know, a lot of people, when they think of green sauce, think of a salsa verde or a pesto. Green sauces are just a great way to use up odds and ends of, you know, green onion tops and maybe like half a bunch of cilantro. And I had these tomatillos. I had made tomatillo jam, and I had measured everything out for that recipe. And then I had these a few left over and just kind of blanched them and blitzed them up in a blender like I would start a salsa. And then just kind of took it a step further and thought, you know, there's a restaurant in San Francisco that has a green fish stew. And I kind of like thought of that. And I just kind of thought this sauce thinned out with a little bit of stock, reduced a little bit, would be phenomenal with fish. And it's actually one of my favorite recipes in the book. And after the photo shoot, I had friends over and we all shared this like massive pot of tomatillo stew with tortillas, and a really, really simple salad with radish. And it was wonderful.
It looks so vibrant and colorful. The photos in the book are incredible, but the green fish stew, it's another one. I can't wait to go home and try it.
It's my favorite tomatillo recipe by far.
Michelle, these are such great ideas. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Noelle. Thanks for having me.
Michelle McKenzie's book is Dandelion and Quince, Exploring the Wide World of Unusual Vegetables, Fruits, and Herbs. Noelle Carter is the Los Angeles Times Test Kitchen Director and writes the Culinary SOS column. Now, Michelle left us with a recipe for those smoked fig leaf cookies, and you can find it at splendidtable.org. And it's your last chance to register for this month's giveaway, a set of Zwilling J.A. Henkels knives. Register to win at splendidtable.org. Coming up, what is life like for a legendary cake baker still going strong at 87? I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Melanie Denae is a celebrity photographer, creator of My Last Supper, and a contributor here on The Splendid Table. Melanie, it's good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
So you're bringing us a story about a cake designer who is 87 years old and still at it. So tell us about her.
Yes, Sylvia Weinstock. I met her years ago when I photographed her for a magazine. We became friends, and I was fascinated by her very specific artisanal trade. And I finally convinced her 10 years into our friendship to let me come and work in the workshop making the – she's famous for large wedding cakes, mm-hmm. cakes in general, but particularly that are covered with sugar flowers. So I convinced her to let me sort of tag along and start to make the sugar flowers, which is so difficult. And you have to really have delicate hands, which I don't. So I worked for about a month in the workshop. And finally, one day, she needed an extra hand, and I got to go and as a cake worker to the Middle East with her to help install a cake for the royal family.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean, you look at her cakes and you think three times about even moving them across a room.
All over the world. So I was embedded in the Middle East, as I called it, a cake slave. Don't get mad, Sylvia. For 7 days installing this cake for the royal family of a country that I probably shouldn't say. It was taller than it was. The inspiration was like a huge chandelier, and it was from the floor to the ceiling of an enormous ballroom. Mm-hmm. It was stunning, and it was so much work. There were about 8 boxes of cakes that literally were hand. We put them on the plane. We took them off the plane. By the time they came out of those boxes, all those miles away, there was not a dent. I can't even bring a cake from the oven to the table. They are perfect. And the whole thing took us a week.
So you had a conversation with Sylvia. Let's listen.
Hello, Sylvia Weinstock. It's so nice to have you here.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you.
So being the cake guru of America, shall we call you, do you actually still like making cakes?
I like the product. You know, it's not the making so much, but it is meeting the client, getting to know them, poking into their lives, which I love, and then designing with them, trying to figure out where their level of taste goes and the event, what it should look like, how it should blend and not overpower and still be a memorable item. And probably the best part is the day or two later, a thank you. And then maybe in about 18, 20 years, the daughter gets engaged and you do the next generation.
That's fabulous.
So that's the best part of the business.
So when you meet a couple, so they come and they have a tasting, do you know right away, because you have a degree in psychology, right?
Yes.
Do you sort of...
do you figure out, is this a good one? Well, many of them are good ones as they come in. But, you know, down the line, 5 years, 10 years, who knows? Do they still have the same values? Are they still good friends? Do they make a life together? I do get to do the second and third weddings of the original bride, and I'm always asking, what happened?
Didn't you just do a cake for a woman who's 87 or 90?
91. and a half, almost 92, getting married for the third time to a younger man, younger meaning about 78 years old. And she says he's the dream of her life. Now, this is not the first husband. She was married for 30 years to one man who died. Then she was married to another man, unfortunately, who died. And now she has an opportunity to keep the 78-year-old alive.
That is amazing.
It is amazing.
Did you do her other cakes, too?
No, unfortunately. This is the first one. And she's a working woman. She is still working in her firm as the head of an architectural firm at the age of 91. So that's an inspiration to all of us who say, I'm so tired. She's not.
You've done so many cakes for so many famous people, birthday cakes, wedding cakes. What is your biggest triumph, do you think? What was your biggest success?
My biggest triumph is to survive, which is not always easy. When you own a small boutique business, you have an overhead, you have very skilled workers, and then you have to be able to pay the rent, and you have to be able to charge for a cake. Boutique people don't make money. They make money on accessories. So if you look at Chanel and Dior and Saint Laurent, you realize that that's the case. We have not really come up with accessories yet.
Has it become more difficult these days?
It has become more difficult in terms of logistics because we do travel with cakes. We go all over the world. So you have to arrange transportation. You get one shot. You cannot have an error or a mistake. And the pressure is exhausting.
What's the farthest that a cake has actually traveled?
Well, we've gone to Abu Dhabi, Kuwait. We've gone to Bahrain. We've gone through Europe. We've gone to South Africa. We went to Johannesburg with a cake. And now we have a license to do business with people in Japan.
So your signature, one of your signatures, besides not using fondant and having this delicious buttercream frosting, is flowers, sugar flowers. Tell me about those.
Well, when I first started, you could get a very beautiful cake that you could hardly eat because it took 2 weeks to decorate it. And it was dry and tasteless. Or you got a delicious cake that didn't look pretty. The object was to develop a way to make the decorations in advance so you could store them on the shelf and produce a fresh cake within 24 or 40 hours. And you just affix the flowers. But I was a gardener, and I loved flowers, and I would look at them and say, why can't I duplicate this in sugar by making the sugar very thin within my hand, as I used to be a kindergarten teacher and use Play-Doh, roll it with your fingers very fine, and try to duplicate the flower. And the first one I remember was a rose. So I got the rose, and I took it apart petal by petal, laid it out neatly in a row, and then duplicated the petals and tried to put them together the way I had taken it apart. And lo and behold, I found that I, with practice, could make a beautiful rose. Then I was off and running. We make flowers every day, and each of the ladies has a specialty of a flower that she likes to make. So Nora likes to make tulips, and I have someone who makes roses and someone who makes lily of the valley or sweet peas or freesia or poppies or peonies or whatever is seasonal.
So you're going to Japan. What's next?
Anything, wherever they want me. Would I like to go to China? Yes. Would the Indians in India like to have our cakes? Yes. As a matter of fact, we did send one to India a while ago. But I think anybody who would appreciate the quality of what we do and understands the beauty and the uniqueness, we'll entertain them.
Let them eat cake.
Let them eat cake and have a wonderful party and a long and happy life.
Thank you so much, Sylvia.
It was my great pleasure to talk to you.
Sylvia Weinstock is the creator of Sylvia Weinstock Cakes. Melanie Dunay is a photographer and the creator of My Last Supper. Now, you can see photos of some of Sylvia's cakes on the website, splendidtable.org. And we have collected wonderful recipes for some gorgeous cakes, also with photos, on that very same site, splendidtable.org.
turmeric has the looks. It's gorgeous golden yellow, colors curry powder, and anything it touches. Someday I'll show you my kitchen towels. But beyond color, cooking with it challenges the imagination. Well, Julie Sani, the Indian food expert, knows turmeric inside out, which is why our correspondent, David Leet, turned to her for some answers.
Julie, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So turmeric, poor, lonely, misunderstood turmeric. Not a lot of people know what to do with it. So why don't we start from the beginning? What exactly is turmeric?
Turmeric is like ginger. It's a rhizome. Mm-hmm. And it does give yellow color. So therefore, that's what most people know it for.
Exactly.
Like a coloring agent. But actually, it's unbelievable the healing properties it has, and of course, culinary, which is amazing. You could buy it as a fresh rhizome in the grocery section, the way you buy fresh ginger.
Right.
But most popular is in the form of powder, the way you buy chili powder. It's ground.
Julie, what are some of your favorite ways of cooking with turmeric?
Well, turmeric is a powder, you know, the way we use it, turmeric powder. So it will burn very easily if you put it in hot oil directly. Mm-hmm. So you have to know how to keep the oil at a very low temperature when you're adding turmeric, or you add the turmeric and immediately dump the vegetable or the meat so that it stops
from
burning.
Lowers the temperature.
The temperature. The other thing is to put it in the liquid itself and create a kind of a broth and then cook ingredients in it. I particularly like when it is added to vegetables directly or chicken, for example. I will put it on a marinade and all. In rice also, it's wonderful because you can make beautiful yellow rice, which is very popular in northwestern part of India. So if you have a cooked vegetable or uncooked, if it is a quick cooking vegetable like a zucchini or broccoli.
Right.
And then you heat the oil. And as the vegetable is going in there, you put garlic in there also, and you put the turmeric in it. You put tiny bit of salt and you stir fry that for about a few minutes, like a couple of minutes, so that the turmeric kind of spreads and the garlic also gets slightly, you know, cooked. And then if it is a vegetable that's going to cook, take only 2 minutes, then you are done with it. If it is going to take more time, like a broccoli sometimes take more time. So you put a little bit of broth, cover it up, cook it. I like to use white wine, but that's okay. So I like it in the stir-fried form. However, if you are going to use it as a marinade, which I love it, because if you combine black pepper with the turmeric and a little bit of ginger, it's like 1, 2, 3, 4. So if you have one portion of black pepper, you have 2 portions of turmeric, you have 3 portions of ginger,
okay, you got me.
And the 4 portion of lemon or lime. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Okay? Oh, that sounds wonderful.
And you just have it like a paste.
Yeah.
And then you put this over a fish and set it aside. And then when you're ready to cook, just very lightly, just dust it with chickpea flour, which is kind of a very good for you. It's a very low in glycemic index.
Pan sear that?
Pan sear it with very little of oil.
Yeah.
If you don't want that oil, then you can just simply put it in the oven and just bake it.
Roast.
Yeah, or put it even in a, I know some people don't like microwave, but I love microwave, so you can just microwave the fish. Don't overcook
the fish.
You know, my line is that fish, you already killed a beautiful creature. Don't kill it the second time.
Right, exactly, the second time. And then in your cookbook, there's turmeric potatoes with green peppers.
Yes. It's very simple recipe. It's the way people cook in India on an everyday basis. They don't use 10, 20 spices the way most people are getting to believe Indian food is. And essentially, you boil potatoes, Yukon Gold, or even just any variety of white potato, boil them in the jacket. About 20 minutes it'll take for a good 2, 2.5-inch potato. And you peel them, cut them into big chunks. And then you heat the oil, and then you sprinkle the turmeric, salt, and pan roast it. And when it is being pan roasted, you cut up beautiful peppers, red, green, yellow, orange, and pan sear it, and they all get the coating of the turmeric also on it. It's so delicious. I love it just like that with the, you know, eggs in the morning or just snack.
That sounds wonderful. It was a pleasure having you on the show, Julie. Thank you.
Thank you, David. It was total pleasure for me too.
Author and cooking teacher Julie Sane leads culinary tours through India. Now you can find out more information at juliesane.com. David Leet is the publisher of leetsculinaria.com. And you can try our recipe for almond turmeric potatoes. It's there on the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, I get a chance to talk to you. You can reach me at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
Yeah. Look like you need some fixing in your kitchen. That's right, I said it looked like you need some fixing in your kitchen. I'm here to help you. Yes, indeed. Some fixing in your kitchen. I'm the one you're looking for.
It is time to turn to your calls. You can reach us on Twitter, you can find us on Facebook, and you can call 800-537-5252. All burning or not burning questions are welcome. Let's see, we have got Leslie calling from Williamsburg, Massachusetts. Leslie, welcome.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I really enjoy your show.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Recently, I finished a bottle of kosher dill pickles, and then I noticed that the brine or the pickle juice was kind of a shame to throw it away.
So right.
Now I have two bottles of this pickle brine, and I was wondering if there's anything that I could do with it.
You are singing my song. I cannot let a jar of pickles and that brine go to waste. I have them in the refrigerator. It's hysterical. There's all these jars filled with greenish liquid. But, okay. Number one, slice up onions. And you'll have pickled onions. They will be so delicious. And you can use those as they are in salads, you know, on sandwiches, however you want, raw. But the other thing is you can pat them a bit dry and saute them. And they have a whole different flavor. You can literally take them out and put them on the grill. And the other thing that I like to do with them is I chop them in, you know, if you're making a chicken salad or you're doing any kind of, you know, chopped tomato and zucchini and cucumber and all of that, throw these in. So that's number one. Number two, and now this is from a pickle crazy person. One of the things I love to do with something like, you know, the kosher brine is to get a jar of sweet pickles, the gherkins, right, and cut them in halves or in quarters and put them in the brine. And you get this lovely combination of the sweet and the salt and the bit of garlic and all of the things that makes a kosher pickle utterly fabulous, but it has a sweet, kind of interesting overtone with some lovely sweet spices in there. So that's another thing you can do. You can put green tomatoes in there. You could partially cook green beans and then put those in. You could thin slice carrots and put them in. You could do the same thing with radishes. You think of a vegetable that is good to eat raw. Celery is another thing, okay? If it's good to eat raw, it's really going to be interesting in that brine. Cauliflower.
would be wonderful in that brine.
How long should you leave it in the brine?
Well, I would say whatever you do, you're going to have to keep it refrigerated. And quite frankly, I think after a week or so, you know, you want to have it more or less finished up. And if you have any doubts, you can just add a tad more vinegar to the brine.
What type of vinegar were you using?
Almost anything. I mean, you could even use white vinegar, which normally I'm not crazy about, but because you've got a lot of flavor in the brine, the idea is that between the salt and the vinegar, those are two great preservatives. And anything, any microbes or whatever that might be a little troublesome generally for a short period of time, if you're holding something, you know, for a week cold, they should be fine. So if cheapest would be white vinegar. I use cider vinegar all the time. I think either one of those would be just great. And almost all vinegar these days, if you look on the label, has a 5% acidity level. That's not super acidic, but it's generally going to be okay. If you can find a 6 or 7%, it's all the better. 5%'s been watered down a bit.
Good suggestion. Okay, thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Send us an email, splendidtable.org. Check us out on Facebook and Twitter. You know, the apples are coming in now. We've got a ton of choices. And it's pie season. But the big thing with a pie is which apples to use. Now, I have to tell you right now that any apple that has the word delicious in its name, I think does not work for pie. In fact, I'm not crazy about them for eating. But what you want with an apple pie is first an apple that's going to remain firm, and secondly, at least half of the apples be tart, really tart, because that way it sets off the other things that you add to the pie, the brown sugar and the spices. So what I want to do when I make a pie is I look for apples that are usually green, believe it or not, like Empire, Granny Smith, Great Northern. These are generally apples that are going to stay firm and they have a nice crisp tart edge. Now, to complement them, I want something that's also going to hold its shape, but I want something that's rich and sweet. And this is where apples like Honeycrisp, which is super sweet and crunchy, Sweet Tango, which is similar, the old-fashioned Wine Sap. Wine Sap has a slightly tart edge, and the name is so beautiful, and it has a wine-like quality. So you want a sweet apple that's going to stay really, really crunchy. Gala is good. Pink Lady is good. Mix those half and half, or two-thirds tart and one-third sweet, and you're off and running. So think sweet and tart. That's what works in an apple pie. And by the way, for great apple pie recipes and dynamite pastry crusts, go to the website, splendidtable.org. 800-537-5252. Renee from Earhart, South Carolina. You had a question, I think.
I do. And thanks for taking my call.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thanks. My husband slaughtered about 5 Cornish cross hens.
Uh-huh.
He smoked one, but I want to know what is the best way to bake one and with what sort of spices. They're about 7 to 8 pounds.
Okay. And these are Cornish hens, you said?
Cornish cross. We think they're jumbo Cornish. They're meat chickens.
I understand. Okay. Now, have they been free range? I mean, have they been roaming through the grass and all of that?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, boy, they're going to be good. So they're pretty big. So this is what I do to make sure you get some tenderness from them. Because sometimes when they've been very active, all those lovely muscles make for chewy meat. Mm-hmm. But delicious, beyond delicious. Mm-hmm. Have you ever cooked one of these before?
We've smoked one, but I've never cooked one in the oven. Not one that we've raised straight off. You know.
How tender are the smoked? Is the smoked one?
It was pretty tender. It was tender and juicy.
Oh boy, that's okay. Then that's exactly what I needed to know. This is what I would do. First thing I would do is, if you want to, you can brine this, which will make it even juicier, and that would be that you brine an hour for every pound. Okay. So it's 5 pounds you brine for 5 hours. And usually the balance here is for every cup of water, okay, cold water, you want about a teaspoon to 2 teaspoons of something like kosher salt or coarse salt. Okay. And then I always use an equal amount of sugar because that keeps the meat from kind of, I can't explain it, except it gets hard with just salt. And you can throw in whatever seasonings you want, but use a lot of them because otherwise you won't taste anything from the seasonings. And so you do this and you make sure you have ice cold water and you put them in a big plastic bag or a deep bowl and you put them in the fridge and you let that thing go for 5 hours or 7 hours and then you rinse it and that's it. Now you can marinate it or whatever. But what I would do then is I would take it, I'd put it breast side down on a rack over a roasting pan. And the first thing I would do would be to rub a little butter, or if you have bacon fat, it would be wonderful, you know, over the meat and put it in the oven at about 400 degrees for about a half hour. Then knock the heat down to about 325. And you want to roast it breast side down until when you stick an instant reading thermometer into the thickest part of the thigh. Okay, this is the part, don't touch bone if you can avoid it. It's at 165 to 170 degrees. You can also test the center of the breast. The idea is you want to test the deepest, thickest part of the meat for doneness. And 165 degrees is about right. Okay, and at that point, you pull it out. And you let it rest for about 10, 15 minutes. All the juices will gather. All the flavors blossom. And then you serve it.
Yum. Excited.
Now, if you want to baste it with any kind of barbecue sauce or, you know, one of the things that's fun to do is something like pineapple juice, soy sauce, and garlic, and a little bit of fresh lime or vinegar. And then you just baste that on in the last hour or so of cooking, half hour or so of cooking. But figure you're going to be cooking it low and slow. So it may be 15, 20 minutes to the pound. Okay. Does that make sense?
Yes, ma'am. I'm writing it all down.
Okay. But if you check online, too, you're going to see, look up anything that's about roasting a big chicken or a little turkey. And that whatever the guideline is, that'll be the one. And then as far as the seasoning goes, you can use anything that you like at all.
Yay. I'm excited. Thank you.
It's going to be delicious. It's going to be wonderful. And these sound like wonderful animals.
Yes, I'm excited that we're doing this because we've been wanting to grow our own food, and so this is good.
This is really good. Renee, good luck with it, and great project, growing your own food. Take
thank
care.
You, and I enjoy your show.
Hey, thank you. Take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thanks for calling. Take the funkiness of a super ripe cheese, like Limburger. Mix it with the sliminess of okra and the texture of overcooked beans, and you have natto. In Japan, folks obsess over it. It's a delicacy, and some say habit-forming. Like kombucha, kimchi, and other fermented foods, it's rich in nutrients. Now, we here in the States have a chance to become natto-obsessed as well. There's a Japanese microbiologist turned food entrepreneur who's producing organic GMO-free natto in New York. She's Dr. Ann Yonatani, a teacher at the New School. She loves natto and started making and selling this pungent superfood out of an organic food business incubator in Queens. Our contributor, Von Diaz, who doesn't shy away from the fermented, sat down with Anne to talk about why we should all be eating natto.
Anne, thanks so much for being here.
Hi. Hi, Von. I'm excited to be here.
So I recently tried your natto, and I have to say, it's a little hard to describe. How would you describe it?
How would I describe it? Well, I think it's delicious. but for those who've never had it before, Natto is simply steamed whole soybeans that comes with its own special sauce.
And what is that special sauce like?
That special sauce is, for lack of a better word, kind of slimy, like maybe the mucilage that you get from cooked okra, a cross between that and the stringy marshmallow strings that you get from a Rice Krispie treat.
That's pretty accurate for my remembrance. And what about the texture?
Again, it's sort of a cross between those two things. And I think for a lot of first-time eaters of natto, the texture is the thing that is the most surprising mm-hmm. and perhaps polarizing.
Texture is a big thing for a lot of eaters.
Mm-hmm.
How long has natto been around?
It's quite an old food. It's been around for at least a millennium.
Wow.
In Japan, possibly longer. I learned recently that it may even have had older origins in China, like many things, cultural things in Japan do.
And how is it typically eaten?
Typically, the Japanese would eat it for breakfast, actually.
Just on its own, or?
Not usually on its own, usually mixed with rice and soy sauce or other condiments of choice, sometimes chopped scallions or vegetables. Raw egg is another common Japanese addition.
Mm-hmm.
I tell people who are not Japanese to sort of think out of the box and not feel like they need to eat it with rice. Mm-hmm. In Japan, everyone has a rice cooker full of rice that's always on, you know.
Yeah.
So for people in America who may not have rice lying around, I think it's useful to think of natto as a stinky cheese in bean form.
Mm.
Really, that's what it is. It's like a vegan stinky cheese, the closest thing a vegan can eat to like a really strong, like washed rind cheese, like an Epoisse or a Taleggio mm-hmm. or a Chimay, something, you know, in that vein of cheese. So if you like that kind of fermented food, then, you know, natto really may be easy for you to like if you can get over the texture thing.
And how do you eat it at home, you personally?
You know, I put it on pasta, on toast, pizza. It's great with eggs of any kind.
Scrambled in them or on them or?
Anyway.
Okay.
Yeah. Great on deviled eggs. That's one of my favorite.
So how is natto made?
The process is pretty simple. I start with dried soybeans, GMO-free soybeans from a particular varietal that's special for making natto. And so the beans are simply washed and soaked to hydrate them and then steamed. So they're cooked soybeans when they're inoculated with Bacillus subtilis and then fermented for just one day. And then aged for about a week or so to develop flavor and texture before it's ready to eat or sell.
And
but, you know, like anything, any simple task, to do it really well, you know, it's all in the details. There are a million little things that can make a difference in the quality of the final product.
Thanks so much for being here, Anne.
Thank you, Vaughn.
Anne Yonatani is owner of Nurture, New York Natto. Von Diaz is a food writer and radio producer at StoryCorps. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And until next time, let me leave you with this thought from Sylvia Bornstein, who said, "The mind is like tofu. It tastes like whatever you marinate it in." SplendidTable.org has just about everything you'll ever need. And if you like what you heard here today, be sure to subscribe to our podcast on your favorite podcast app. And for a daily dose of food inspiration, make sure you're following us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Pinterest. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Courtney McEwen. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Sally Swift is our managing producer.
Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.